the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. M.J. Young is my guest this week. His new book is a novel entitled A Ship's Tale. Although this is his first novel, M.J. Young has been involved in the arts for a while. He's a visual artist, a filmmaker, a playwright, and a musician. M.J. Young, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on board.
Since The Ship's Tale is a novel and there's some suspense involved, I'm going to ask you to tell us, you know, what you think we should know about the story before we talk about it.
Well, maybe a little background on the era wouldn't hurt. It's a year after World War II, and for the next 7 years, Britain had gone on serious rationing and rebuilding while the U.S. was having a boom time here. And the part of the story is that from the beginning of the war, when they used everything that would float for the war effort, from Dunkirk, for example, barges, fishing boats, all these different, anything that would float, to the most ghastly things that some of them didn't make it back on. And anyway, once these arrived back in the UK and the war was over, they were useless to them, and if they couldn't be sold off foreign flags, or if they couldn't be otherwise utilized, they were scrapped, either in the scrap yards, or as one of the old men I talked to said that he saw a couple tall ships just taken out and had their hulls breached, and they sank them. And they would have done anything if they could have saved them, but at that point, they didn't. So that's pretty much where A Ship's Tale starts out. It starts out by a group of regular people like you, me, and tradesmen. There's no guns, no swords, no swashbuckling. It's just the power of arm, heart, and brain to make this happen, because they approach the Admiralty to help them save the vessel and are denied. So then what's really interesting is people that I had spoken to that grew up there and also were there after the war were telling me stories that were quite almost unbelievable, but they were true. I later found out it's like if they were throwing out the trash, that's fine, but somebody goes and steals the trash, well, hey, you're in a world of hurt, especially if you belong to the Admiralty.
So the characters in your story try to steal this ship to keep it from being destroyed.
Yeah, well, we'll use the word liberate. Yeah.
Now, how much of your story is based on historical fact? I mean, was there a Bonnie Clyde?
Yeah, but it was called the Will Scott, actually. And that was taken out and unceremoniously scuttled in the English Channel. And the characters in the book were based on real people who were there and actually took part in a lot of what is written, well, everything that's written there.
And there's also heroes and villains and a dancing bear in the story. But what was it that drew you to this? Is it the theme of a person who's kind of after World War II finding some noble cause for his life? Or what was it that drew you to the story?
What drew me to the story was I had it sort of in the back of my brain. I started to think about these old guys that I I knew when I was a kid, when I say old guys, now I look back and I think, you know what, they probably weren't much older than I am now. Sounds pretty bad. But they had a lot to do with things that I knew about, and I just felt like, you know, it's really sad that all this had been passed up. It's almost like an era or a time and situations that no one else had written about. And I thought one evening, what if these guys could go back for one last time? How could you possibly take an old ship like this, an old square rigger, and take it out on an ocean that they just fought wars on, and make it completely disappear, and the Admiralty not be able to find it, even though they found everything else during the war? And I started to think about it. I started to ponder thoughts, and the thoughts came, and they came, and they came. And then the story just started going in my mind and in my mind. And one night, I had the occasion to go out sailing on San Francisco Bay, and excuse me, bad throat today. And there was a lot of VIP people around, and I didn't really get on that element a lot. And I mean, I just don't care about it too much. But a guy came up, and we were sitting on deck, and I was enjoying the night, and we just started talking about stories, and he started talking about films, and then I don't know how we got on to talking about this story, and but he started asking me questions about the story. Well, if this happened, then how could that happen, and how did this happen, and how did that happen? And so I had the answers to all the questions. And he sort of scratched his head, and he said, you know what? This is a hell of a story. You ought to write it down. Oh, no, that's not what he said. He said, do you have it written? I said, well, no, it's all up here. I pointed in my head, and he said, well, no, it would. You got to write it. I said, well, you know, I don't do books. That's not really my thing. He said, well, nobody else is going to do it. And you ought to really consider putting it together. So I thought about that, and we talked about other things and other stories. And as he was, when we got back to port, and he was leaving the ship, the lady who owned it came back and said, well, gee, I didn't know you knew Alan. I sort of figured you might. And I said, Alan who? The guy you were talking to here for the last 2 or 3 hours. I said, well, actually, we just sort of met tonight, but I didn't really get his name. And she rolled her eyes and looked at me, and she said, well, congratulations. This makes you an asshole of the evening. That's like, excuse me? I said, well, that was Alan Arkin you were talking to.
You didn't recognize him.
I didn't. I didn't. The last time I had seen him, he wasn't bald, and he was probably 100 pounds heavier. And I just was in my own kind of world, and I wasn't really thinking about it.
Yeah.
So, having heard that, I went back, and I started to dictate it through, with a microphone.
Oh yeah, well, I want to ask you about that. You wrote your book entirely using, according to your foreword in the book, you wrote the entire book using voice recognition software.
Yeah, I did. I did.
How does that work for you?
It's amazing. I wouldn't be answering emails in person, or I for sure wouldn't be doing a lot of the my own letters and things. This would just dictate them and have somebody else take care of them. But with this story, I went in and I have access to all this recording equipment. So I started to record it, and I sent it out to all these people to do transcriptions. And when it came back, it was nowhere near what I wanted or what I had in mind or whatever. So I ended up, long story short, I fired everybody. And somebody told me about this voice recognition program. And I tried one, and I hated it. And tried the other one, and I didn't like that one either. And then the third one I tried was Charm. And it worked really well.
We're talking with N.J. Young, and his book is called A Ship's Tale. What do you want to tell us what voice recognition software it is?
I don't really advertise for anything.
Yeah, okay.
But it's called Dragon Naturally Speaking, the preferred edition. The thing that I like about the new version is you click one, and it will do your your British spelling. You click the other one, and you'll be doing your American spelling, and you can train it that way.
Well,
that didn't exist when I did it, no.
Oh, well, it's really interesting, because you don't speak with a British accent, although...
No.
Your book is... I mean, you don't write it in a dialect. One of your characters is in dialect, but your narrator is British, and there's a certain quality of British English to the book. I mean, you can kind of hear a British accent when you're reading it. So how did you manage that? Were you like an actor playing the part?
Well, I've been around a lot of British people. Been a lot around some Scottish people and Irish people, and I sort of knew how the dialect flowed. And I think one of the things I found most amusing was, you know, as a kid, you're sitting in a room, and then there's the Scotsman sitting there, and then the Irishman would walk in. Even though they were friends, they had some of the best insults. And I wish I could have remembered all of them. but I remembered a lot of them that went into that book. And, you throw in an Englishman and a Russian, and you have the makings for a war right there. So all these people who they have to pull together for one common purpose, even though we have them going after each other on the different ways to make it happen. So I got the idea about how to write for them just by writing it down and showing it to some people with that background. And the first person that read it all through, the British guy, and he said he had no idea, it had no title on it. The working title was called A Conspiracy of Sailors. And he read that through, and he said, oh my, he said, where did this guy must have grown up in Kent who wrote this book. This is really interesting. He said, is it ever going to go out for publication? So I said, well, you know, I need to make a few changes, and once I do, then yeah, that'll happen. But it wasn't anybody that grew up in the UK that did that.
How do you compare, if you can, the experience of writing a novel with the previous work you've done in some of the other mediums that you've worked in?
Well, they certainly are a whole lot shorter and easier to deal with.
It's easier to write a song.
You're dealing with a few lines here or there and a poem, a thought, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then you're done. But when you sit down and you have over 300 pages worth of dialogue in which to, I don't know, the story just kept going. It just started taking off a life of its own.
Did you always know where you were going when
I knew where it was going, but it took me places that I never thought I'd be when I did it.
You know, I guess we call it a historical novel, even though it's it's very recent history, but it's kind of interesting because right now, my father died a few years back. He was 82, and he was a young veteran of World War II. So I guess we're getting to the point where there's very few people who hold this period in their living memory.
Yeah, that was also one of the things that came to my mind when I started this is, and as much as I tried to find any living member of even the family members of these people, it was impossible. So there I was, a blank sheet of paper, and I was like, okay, you remember it, you got to make it happen. So, and then there's a whole other, there's a lot of different styles writers have. And, if you look around at a novel, it's not the same as a movie. You always get that thing where, meanwhile, back at the ranch, this is going on.
Right.
And, and that didn't work. It didn't work. I tried to do that and show the other side, but that was not happening. And I thought, this the only way this is going to work is in the first person. One guy tells a story.
Right. So at some point, rather than having Flynn tell the story, you had the omnipotent narrator kind of approach?
Yeah.
That's interesting. It kind of feels like it could be a movie, but it would be a long movie. But I guess, did you tell me that they're thinking about making a film?
Yeah, I just put one in the director's hands today. And because he's done a bunch of work, and I've seen his films quite a bit. And he had been dealing with this agency in England, and I've been dealing with it for a while, and finally, I just took it away from him and said, temporarily just put all this stuff on hold. And I gave him the book, and I said, well, what do you need from me? He said, I need a treatment. I need a treatment, which is a 14-page breakdown of the entire book. It can't be more than 14 pages. And it's like, oh, my God. All the things that go on there, and it's got to be done in 14 pages. So he suggested another writer in L.A., and I said, no, I've really had it with other writers. I don't want anybody involved in it. So anyway, I got it done in 10 pages.
You did. It's interesting that you don't want to work with any other writers because, in music, it's a very collaborative thing where you have a band of people you're working with.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a great thing to do is collaborations in music. I mean, that's what really makes music work. But it wasn't going to work with us.
Uh-huh.
Because this book was just me, and the only person who was going to see this when I was done was the editor, and then we were going to shop a publisher.
Yeah. Well, one of the in an email that we had a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned to me that Walter Cronkite read your book, and he does write a little blurb on your book. The late, great Walter Cronkite. How did he come to read your book?
I went to Mystic Seaport when I had the first release of the book. And I was doing a sort of very low-key book signing thing. And book signing. And then I said... We were talking with one of the guys that works at Mystic as a blacksmith, wonderful guy. And I said, there are a lot of, we were talking about people who we like, people who are our heroes, people who we admired and things. And Walter Cronkite was one of the names that fell out of my mouth. And he said, Walter, yes, Walter's on the board here at Mystic. And I said, is that so? Well, how can I get him a book? He said, well, hand me one. I said, no, I don't want to do that. Why don't you give me or I can send him a letter, because I want to ask permission to send him the book. I don't want to just throw it at him. Too many people do that. That's where authors make their worst mistakes. It's just, well, somebody will love this book. I want to just, you know, send it to them. So I wrote to Walter Cronkite, care of CBS. His personal assistant wrote back and said, Walter would love a copy of the book. And then I sent it to him. And I was surprised, I mean, just astonished when I picked up the telephone. And,
did he say, this is Walter Cronkite?
Years. Hey?
Did he say, this is Walter Cronkite?
Well, yeah, he said hello. And I said, yes. And he said, this is Walter Cronkite. Yeah, that's exactly how he opened it up. And I heard the voice, and I knew it was him. And it's like, you know, I'm never lost for a comeback, a retort. And I just sat back in my chair, and I said, Mr. Cronkite, I said, this is amazing. I said, I had actually sent you a book, and I all this was leaving my brain as to, you know, what had transpired, that she got the book, she gave him the book, he read the book, and then somehow he got a hold of me. And there he was. He said, I just wanted to call. He said, God, I love this book. This is amazing. And then he started asking me questions, because he was over in Britain in World War II.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, Walter, the AP reporter in the story is loosely based on you. And because he was a real fan of the ham radio. Ham radio was pretty much for Bolton and Britain during the war. They were worried about spies and saboteurs and all those other stuff that I guess you worry about in wars. But afterwards, or I don't know, when they started to win the war, it sort of took over like the internet. And people were talking at the end. And Mr. Cronkite was a great fan of ham radio. And so, anyway, not one in this equip. He said, you patterned that after me, huh? I said, yeah. He said, well, why the hell did you make me seasick? I said, well, yeah, because the reporter spends the night on the tugboat. And he's miserable throughout this whole experience at sea. And then I can get to say, well, I'll make you more endearing. You know, because it makes you look more human, like the other folks. He said, okay, well then, let's pass that by. And we talked about other things. We talked for a long time. And I was just blown away. He was quite a man, quite a statesman, and we're never going to see anybody in the media like him ever.
No, that's not. I mean, they don't come like that anymore. They don't even want that anymore, I don't think, in the media.
No, they don't. You know, you gotta not. It's all reduced to 15-second sound bites, and
I mean, I think they just want.
You don't get it. You know, Fox News is the comedy channel. And a lot worse things I could say, but I won't use up the time for it.
Well, now you published your book a few years ago, but now there's a new revised 2009 edition. What did you do to the book? Or why did you feel compelled to go back and fix it?
Well, there was the first edition, I mean the first release of the book. There were a lot of blemishes that got by. God, my voice is breaking off. I sound like a little girl here. I'm going to take a shot of this. A lot of it was just in the editing that there were problems. And then the British Arts Council said, well, you know, if this is British content, it's a British story, then when the director applies for, you know, they provide money for a grant, and depending on what it was, they match it dollar for dollar for money that's raised. And I started off with Flynn being, he grew up in America and moved to England when he was young. What that has to do with the story is nebulous. And I should have taken that out in the first place. The reason it was in there in the first place was I figured I'm going to make some mistakes and Flynn would be forgiven if he didn't know all the British, you know, acronyms or such and such. So what I did was, and then accidentally, I had left out a couple of scenes. For instance, there was too many scenes about the cat. And so there was
cat up the
one
tree.
Huge section. I just took that out of there altogether. And then the one thing that I was reading the book and said, I can't believe I missed this, was the truth in the UK at that time, it was that there wasn't a spare bunch of canvas you could get anywhere. And so the only way you could get it was to procure it in the fashion that they did. So when they spent all night disguising, putting mud on the sails to make them look moldy and old to those on the tugboat who looked back and saw all the stuff hanging from the yardarms. And what I had somehow dropped was, because they were in different, on different documents and this and that, moving it around, was the fact that when they set sail, when they finally set those sails, you know, the dust that's given off from the packed mud gives off a cloud of, you know, dirt. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that done only once on a ship where it had really dirty sails, and it was this gigantic puff, and then the sail appeared. And it was like a magic trick. Well, that looks pretty good. And I thought, well, wait a minute, where's the thing in here that shows what happened to the rest of the dirt? Oh, it was admitted. Okay, well, you know, a lot of the mud that had dried now had come raining down on the deck and everybody on there. But, of course, the captain catching most of it. So I thought, here's a scene that's just too priceless to leave out. And so I fixed that. I went back and just nip-tuck, you know, through the book. I wanted to keep it moving. Also, the important things in the story were, even though it's an adventure story, it's also a love story, it's also a comedy. And during the times of the most stress, I put, you know, their laughs where you least expect them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of a sudden somebody would say something and, you know, it's funny.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't expect it there.
Yeah.
Because it's ironic, about 50% of the readership are women. So.
Men don't read as much as women do. What about you? Do you read a lot?
I read when I can.
Yeah.
I read things I like. I when I had put that out, I had written to Clive Cussler.
Right.
On his email, and I said, you know, I'd like to send you this book. I'd like to have your take on it. And so he didn't know. Jay Young from Adam, no one else did. So his email that came back said, I love this book. You're a better writer than I am. I said, wrote back, and I said, Clive, can you give me a better quote than that for I might be able to use? And he said, well, this ought to be a film. How's that? I said, well, that'll work. But there were so many people who started writing after that through the website, ashipstale.com, that I met people like Gary Jobson, who was America's Cup Hall of Fame. He's a good friend of Walter Cronkite's. And that was probably the last project that Walter ever did, was Gary put together the history of the America's Cup on, he edited all the film together, and then he said, well, gee, you know, I don't know, there is nobody I would want other than Walter Cronkite to narrate this. And he contacted Walter's agent. He said, well, he would probably do it, but I don't think you could afford it. And so Walter got a hold of it, looked at the footage, read what Gary had written, and he said, hell, I'll do this for free.
Wow.
And that's the kind of guy he was.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think you'll write more novels now that you've gotten into it?
I have one in the cooker, but it hasn't really, I haven't had as much time to donate to it, and it's going to be a very unpopular subject. And so, yeah, that one will eventually, when the time is right, I'll finish it.
Is there a decision process that you go through where you go, okay, I've got this story to tell, and you have these various ways of telling stories. How do you decide which medium? You're going to do a painting, you're going to do a film, you're going to do a song. How do you decide?
You wake up one morning and something feels good to you, or in the middle of the day, or you're having a conversation, and a little bell goes off, and you make a note, you write it down. And then either something happens with the notes you make for yourself, or they end up, you know, being a good fire starter. You know, you don't know. You never know. You never know. It's a strange checkered career, and what a strange path we all weave through it. But I decided with this one, with this writing of this particular material, is I didn't want it anywhere near any of the other things that I had done. I totally separated it, adopted a pseudonym, and a pen name, rather, and that's the same. And when I gave it to the people I gave it to, including the publisher, including everybody, everything that's been done with this book has been on its own merits. And so we'll still see what the next episode of the story flies.
Well, the novel is called A Ship's Tale, and the author is N.J. Young. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes or Facebook. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne, and thanks to N.J. Young for being my guest this week. His book, again, is called A Ship's Tale. Thanks for listening, everybody. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.